I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Samuel Fleischacker, professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois Chicago, about his 2019 book, Being Me, Being You, Adam Smith and Empathy, from the University of Chicago Press. Fleischacker works on issues in moral and political philosophy, including the notions of culture, liberalism, and religion. He is the author of numerous books and articles, including most recently in 2015, The Good and the Good Book from Oxford University Press. So first of all, Sam Fleischacker, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Sam, I love reading the book. Thank you for writing it. It was really great, clear, penetrating reading of Adam Smith, as well as a philosophical defense of Smithian empathy, of its benefits for our moral and political lives. So both a nice interpretive project and also a good philosophical application of his thoughts, a thing that I really admire in any book. Let me start by asking about the motivation for you writing the book.
So there's a specific incident that I think more than anything actually inspired me to think about writing something like this. This isn't the only motivation. I'll mention a couple of other things as well afterwards. But a few years ago, when one of the Gaza war started in Israel and Palestine, or actually just before, I think it was after those young boys were killed, and then Israeli boys first, and then a Palestinian boy, a local rabbi with whom I've been involved in support groups for the Israeli peace movement called together a rally. It was meant to be a fairly non-political rally of Jews and Muslims standing together basically for peace. Not terribly controversial, just a sort of nice, sweet get-together. And I talked to her about it. I think I helped plan it a little bit, but it was like 2 minutes before we started that she whispered to me, "I'm going to want you to speak." And I thought, what am I going to talk about? And I decided to say something drawing on Smith because I know Smith well. And there's a thought that I'd often had, maybe not exactly in Smith, but using Smith, about how Smith talks about our tendency to empathize most closely with people close to us, our family, our friends, our neighborhoods, our country, or people, but nevertheless wants us to reach out beyond that. This is all in Book 6, where he has various circles of sympathy, as they're called. And my understanding of that had been, not only does he recognize that it's natural that we're all going to first and foremost associate with our sort of more local groups, our kin groups, and the people's political groups and so forth we're close to, but also that because of that, we can address those groups more powerfully than we can address others. And if we want a sort of universal caring for humanity, it's best to work from within our circles of sympathy. So in this case, specifically, Jews urging empathy for Palestinians on Jews, Palestinians urging empathy for Jews to fellow Palestinians. So I said something like that, and it went over quite well. And people told me that it was very interesting. They hadn't thought of it before. And I thought, really? This seemed kind of obvious to me. And I realized that if it seemed obvious, it might have been because I've been thinking about Smith so much. And I realized that although I've written a lot about Smith and sometimes about his, often about his uses for political purposes, I haven't really tried to use him for contemporary moral purposes. And yet I think he's a rich mine for all kinds of issues, especially issues having to do with empathy that are still pertinent today, for thinking through some of our issues about empathy and about our relations to one another in the light of empathy, and also where we need to resist empathy and bring in other kinds of factors. All of that, Smith is a very useful source, and I thought someday I'd like to write a book like that. So that was one important motivation, and then I had also for a while been working on differences between what Smith calls sympathy, that's the 18th century word for what we call empathy, or at least the word Smith and Hume use for that. Differences between Smith and Hume on the issue. And I'd given a sort of version of a paper on the differences between them. And a little while after that, I got an invitation to give a talk at something called a Center for the History of the Emotions. And I thought this is a perfect opportunity to begin to write the book on empathy and Smith that I wanted to write, both drawing out the connections and differences between him and Hume on the issue, and trying to use him for contemporary moral purposes. So those were probably the things that first led me to write the book. And then just around the time I began to get going on it, out came Paul Bloom's Against Empathy. And that was a nice challenge to respond to, and provided a very good, foil in a way, something to answer in the course of the book. So I would say that those three things provided the motivation for the book.
Yeah, that's good. And you've been working on Smith for many, many years. I was just curious as far as the, you know, stepping back and thinking about your career as a whole, which I've enjoyed. You've worked on Kant, you've worked on Herder, you've worked on Smith a lot. Do you find out of all these philosophers, you come back to Smith as the sort of most illuminating of the three? I'm sure it's hard to judge among the three titans, but
well. And one would have to add others. Among the philosophers I find inspiring to me are Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein and Plato. And I do keep coming back to them, at least in my teaching. But actually, the simplest answer to your question is in some ways a kind of boring, pragmatic answer, although it might be one that Smith would approve of. That is that I found a niche here. writing on Wittgenstein, everybody writes on Wittgenstein. Kant mounds stuff on Kant. Kierkegaard's very hard, and hard to write in a way that respects the uniqueness of his own style. And there's also a limited amount that I want to get out of him. And Plato, again, very much a specialty thing. Nobody writes about Smith. I had an opportunity here. So it's not, I don't mean to play him down. Every time I come back to writing and teaching him, I find him very rich, really, really interesting. But I think one reason my own writing has come back to him so much is that this is something which I have at what economists call a comparative advantage. It's a lane that's relatively empty, and there's some hunger for bringing out what's interesting about him philosophically. So I would think that's the main thing. Although I do actually see, as you know, Kantian elements in Smith, ways in which he anticipates Wittgenstein. That's more controversial. Lots of ways in which he brings on board thoughts of the ancients. In many ways, I think of him as closer to ancient moral philosophy than to modern moral philosophy, even though he has a modern political theory. And that's actually in itself interesting, that he looks more like Aristotle or the Stoics, sometimes with a bit of Plato in him, than he does Kant, or certainly than he does John Stuart Mill or a contemporary moral philosopher. So he's an interesting person with whom to think about modernity. And that is something that really fascinates me about him.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just thinking I should add also, he's also much misunderstood. I think the secondary, not only is there very little scholarship on Smith in philosophy, there's a lot in economics and some in history and political science, very little in philosophy, but the scholarship that's out there on Smith as a philosopher, often written by historians and economists, I think gets him very badly wrong a lot of the time. Sorry, you go on.
Mm-hmm. No. I wanted to start talking about empathy, the subject of the book, which is as you point out in the first chapter, really kind of ambiguous term, although some commentators think they know what they pin down on a single concept, but really miss the ambiguity in it. I mean, just to get to the heart of the discussion. I mean, you can feel free to amplify any kind of answer to what do you mean by empathy. But what I found interesting about your book is the way you distinguish between two important types of empathy. One type, as you call it, contagious. Empathy is contagion or contagious empathy, and projective empathy. Contagious as a way in which we catch the emotions of others. Right. It's a form of empathy. And then a projective empathy in the way in which we imaginatively project ourselves into the other, which are very different ways to think about empathy. So maybe feel free to get us started with however you want to answer the question, what is empathy?
Right. Well, as you say, there are a lot of different definitions floating around. Some authors have actually taken that up. The philosopher of mind, Amy Copeland, has an article in which she lays out many different kinds of empathy, which I talk about there. C.D. Batson, who is an important psychologist working on this and very thoughtful, actually, he also distinguishes many different kinds of empathy. I focus on contagious versus projective empathy, because I think they are the kinds of empathy that are most interesting morally, often talked about morally, often, however, run together morally, and that's problematic. And they more or less line up, at least, with the difference between Hume and Smith. So contagious empathy, and although a prominent Hume scholar just got annoyed at me for saying that Hume's notion of empathy is contagion, Hume himself says at one point quite explicitly that we catch other people's feelings, as it were, contagiously. I mean, he uses the word contagion. The crucial point about contagious empathy, and it is true that Hume's account is too complex to be summed up simply as contagious empathy, but it's like it at least and involves a heavy element of contagion, is that I feel what you feel. I feel what you feel because you feel it. And this is a very common and very important phenomenon. When people are all cheerful around you, you tend to feel more cheerful. When they're very depressed or angry, you tend to catch the depression or the anger. That's especially true with close friends or relatives. This may be part of what's explained by way of mirror neurons. It's certainly a basic feature of human life. But projective empathy, in which I feel what I think I would feel in your circumstances, is very different. And the important thing here is the difference. Because what I think I would feel in your circumstances may well not be what you feel. Sometimes it is. You're feeling cheerful, and I think, yeah, I'd be cheerful too if I just got, I don't know, a book contract or an award, or I just got married or something like that. But quite often, either you feel something much more strongly than I do. Smith is very aware of that. What I'm likely to feel in projective empathy is a weaker version of what you feel. Oh, and I should add here, this is very definitely what Smith considers to be empathy. Or sometimes I'll feel something entirely different from what you feel. You're very annoyed by something that I consider to be a minor insult, and I don't think I would feel annoyed at all. I might even think it was a funny joke, which you don't see as a joke. Or vice versa, you're very happy about something, which I think I would actually take as somewhat insulting. Somebody said something which I interpret in a much darker light than you do. Or I simply think that I wouldn't react to something as strong, I wouldn't react in anything like the same way. So in projective empathy, I feel, as it were, on your behalf. I feel as if I were you, but I don't necessarily feel what you feel. And that's really important because it allows me to evaluate your feelings. I can start at least thinking about the possibility that either you are feeling what I consider to be the wrong thing, or I am not feeling the right thing on your behalf. You may accuse me of not adequately sharing your feelings, and I may think that your feelings, the feelings you actually have, shouldn't be shared as they are. You should change them. So there's a possibility of some kind of back and forth in projective empathy, which isn't true in contagious empathy. I either feel what you feel or I don't feel it, and that's the end of the story. This has large implications, I think, for moral theory and for our connection with one another.
Yeah, good. And just as a sort of follow up to thinking about the psychological basis for these different types of empathy, I could see the sort of psychological or even, as you point out, physiological basis for the contagious form of empathy as the mirror neurons that we often hear about and the sort of affective character of that. The projective empathy the sort of psychological structure of it. I mean, we'll get into more, but I wonder if you could just sort of amplify on that a little bit, because in some ways it seems like it requires a sort of bundle or package of different kind of psychological capacities. I mean, there's the imagination, which seems primary, right? In a way that we need to project ourselves into others by way of how we can imagine ourselves in their circumstance. But then there also seems to be an affective component as well, in the sense that I feel vis-a-vis what the other feels. But then there's also a cognitive, a more rationalistic or cognitive component in the sort of the element of judgment that sort of seems to run things, or at least run our emotions. So maybe you could say a little bit about that sort of package, because it seems much more complicated than the affective, or the contagious view.
Right. I mean, I do think that it's more complicated, and in fact, that's an advantage of it. It shows that my empathy with another person is not a simple thing, and it sometimes involves various skills that can be developed or can, on the contrary, atrophy. And in fact, the fact that it brings into play the imagination is a big part of what I want to emphasize. There may be a role for the imagination too, even in contagious empathy, and that's certainly true if we want to identify that with Hume. But there's a much more active role in Smith's projective empathy, because, as you say, I have to think about what your circumstances are like and what it might be like to be in them. But constantly, I am thinking about how I would feel in those circumstances, how those circumstances would feel. So I think there's an affective component even to the use of the imagination here. Now, the thing is, I am reluctant to talk too much from a psychological point of view. Here's where I want to plead disciplinary limitations. I'm a philosopher, not a psychologist, and I'm not even one of those philosophers who sometimes does psychology experiments on the side, which a number of people do these days. So when I start talking about psychology, I tend to use 18th century language, faculty language of imagination and reason and so forth, and those can be a little old-fashioned and also split up too neatly for contemporary purposes. But I think everything you mentioned is definitely a component of projective empathy. I have to imagine myself in your circumstances. That will sometimes require some degree of reasoning. I need to make inferences about what is likely to occur in those circumstances. I may need to bring to bear background information about your history or the history of the culture that you're in. I'm also feeling my way through all of these things. I'm not just coldly looking at your circumstances. A sort of cold understanding of what you're like or what you might be thinking it might be important, and it might be related to projective empathy, but it is not empathy. It's certainly not what Smith calls empathy. I guess what I want to stress is, because Smithian or projective empathy requires all this work, and especially imaginative work, it becomes possible to use it to understand people who are very different from you. In the case of contagious empathy, as Hume acknowledges, you may or may not feel it for someone who comes from a very different culture, looks very different from you, makes you uncomfortable in some way because you're not used to this kind of a person. It could be a matter of sexual orientation. It could be a matter of religion. Often it's a matter of culture. In the case, you just may not feel empathy or sympathy for that person, or at least to any great degree. In the case of projective empathy, because you're using your imagination to think yourself into their circumstances, and that can be very broadly construed to include what their culture might be like, what it might be like to grow up in such a culture, what it might be like to experience the practice of that culture, it becomes at least in principle possible that you could empathize with practically anyone. And I do think that that's an advantage of Smithian empathy, especially in conflict situations. As I said, one of the motivations for my book was thinking about empathy across Israeli-Palestinian lines. And there, empathy can easily be blocked by features of a conflict. However, using projective empathy, using your imagination richly to think about what it would be like if you were one of the other group, makes it at least possible, and sometimes actually true, there are actually groups in Israel-Palestine who work on this, to empathize with members of the other side.
So the complexity. Yeah, right. Go ahead. Sorry, Andrew.
Yeah, no, I was just saying the complexity of projective empathy is an advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that's helpful to sort of move over to some of the, you know, the moral implications here and the moral advantages, disadvantages of these two different types. I mean, because it strikes me in what you were just saying, this could be a disadvantage of the contagious type, right? In conflict situations, contagious empathy can, you know, make in-groups sort of dig in into their own, you know, intensify the fellow feelings such that the conflict becomes worse, whereas projective empathy sort of can open up the division between groups. Go ahead.
I like to underline that a bit. Whenever I think about contagious empathy, I think of it in connection with Elias Canetti's discussion of crowds in his quite interesting book, Crowds and Power, and how a crowd is like a fire in which one thing, an emotion gets caught in this sense, the way a flame can be caught from one dry stick of wood to another. And that, I mean, we see it in all kinds of protests, both for the good and for the bad. Right now, in fact, on our streets, a feeling can rush through a crowd, and sometimes that feeling can lead to very dangerous behavior and very angry reactions, and a feeling on the part of people in the in-group they won't listen to anybody on the outside, and so forth. And projective empathy can stop that. Contagious empathy encourages that, and projective empathy can lead you to take a step back and think, now, wait a second, how would I feel if I were looking at myself or at this next person from the outside? It provides a series of imaginative exercises that can actually block some of the harms of contagious empathy.
Yeah, that's great. So to dig in a little bit more into Smithian projective empathy, which is the subject of your next chapter, you have a description of the process and how it works, and it turns out it has implications that are way more broad and far-reaching than I expected. Certainly about, you know, about the nature of the self. You know, so the metaphysical nature of the self it raises, and we'll get there. I wanted to start with the point, which I found quite interesting, about how one of the ways in which projective empathy, I take it, can get off the ground, or why it's appealing to us. Because in some ways, it seems much more difficult to achieve than contagious empathy. Contagious empathy seems, right. Yeah, it's sort of easy, effective appeal, whereas projective empathy is demanding on us in all sorts of psychological capacities. But one of the points that you make from Smith is the way in which, when we find a kind of attunement with others' feelings, when we imaginatively place ourselves into another and feel their feelings, we get pleasure in mm-hmm. our empathy. And that is a sort of surprising. I find that surprising in a way, because you know, it's hard to envision in the cases in which we're empathizing with someone, say, who's depressed or in a negative state, that we could actually feel, or angry, you know, that we can feel pleasure in empathizing with the negative state. So maybe you could just explain that point and its implications for this sort of solidarity for human beings that you bring out.
Yeah, that's actually one of the aspects of Smithian empathy that I find most fascinating. As you know, the point you're raising just now was actually raised to Smith by David Hume on reading the first edition of Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments. Hume says, surely we can't really take pleasure, joy in empathizing with everybody's feelings, because if their feelings are negative, then surely we're going to feel something negative. And Hume ends with this wonderful line, if you were right, a hospital would be a more entertaining place than a ball. I've had a lot of people say, well, that does it for Smith, as it were. Smith has a complicated answer about how actually there are two components to the empathy. One is the feeling of the other person, and the other is the awareness that I share their feeling. And he says the awareness that I share their feeling is always pleasant, but the feeling itself may not be. And he makes clear that the pleasant part, could be small. So, for instance, when you are mourning with somebody, there is, according to Smith at least, a pleasure in being able to share their pain. I'll get back to that in a second. That even that may seem counterintuitive, but it may be overwhelmed by the pain that you're sharing. And that's actually important. It doesn't mean you're feeling in a great mood. But I actually think Smith could have said back to Hume, as I say at one point in the book, that sometimes a hospital is a more entertaining place than a ball. If you are in a very grumpy mood, or you're angry, or you're very concerned with world problems, being at a ball or some kind of party where everybody's having a great time can feel really annoying, upsetting, and you can feel bad about being out of sync with everyone. And on the other hand, doing something in which you're helping people who are suffering can bring a certain kind of joy. Here's the thing. It's important to Smith, and it's crucial to Smith, and it's crucial to my use of Smith, that we take some pleasure, always get some pleasure out of being able to share feelings with others. Because that's what enables Smith to say that we aspire to doing that. That's what motivates us to try to do it and to keep doing it, even when the feeling is an unpleasant one. It isn't important that that pleasure is the dominant feeling at a certain time. I think it's true that both I'm an observant Jew, and when Jews die, there is something we call Shiva, in which you sit for 7 days, and people come over to your house, and they sometimes bring you food, and they talk to you if you're willing to be talked to, and they just sort of stand around to make you feel better. And it's true. I know when I mourned for my parents, I experienced this, that having those people come over and try to share your pain, as it were, can be comforting. I think it's also true to go and do that for someone else. And why is that a pleasure? What I suggest, and this is actually a pivot point in my book, is that the pleasure is that you know you share the feelings of other human beings. And that's partly a pleasure because it isn't obvious. Sometimes you can feel very emotionally isolated from other people. I think both bullies sometimes and people who are bullied feel cut off from the rest of society. And knowing that what you are feeling isn't weird, as it were, isn't unhuman, that other people share it, can be a real pleasure. It's a very important pleasure, in fact, I think. It's a way in which we feel our common humanity. But yes, it's certainly true that in some circumstances, that pleasure is outweighed by other kinds of pain. And I've also had raised to me as an objection that, you know, sometimes people don't want you coming around and sharing their pain. And I even had a commentator on the book say, point out that sometimes parents who, say, suffer, God forbid, the loss of a child, the marriage breaks up because they can't take having the same feelings over time. And to that, I want to say there's a difference between sharing someone's feelings and expressing that, or how you express that. I certainly, in certain cases, do not want people coming up to me when I'm trying to deal with a very painful moment of my own, whether that be grief or shame or something. I don't necessarily want people coming up to me and telling me I know how you feel and going on and on. I may not want them to talk to me at all. But if somebody truly empathizes with me, they really understand how I feel, then they won't. They won't go on, and they certainly won't tell me that they know how I feel when I think they don't. And I think what goes wrong when two people share a great tragedy is that they ineptly express it to one another. They instead of helping each other out of it, they bring each other further into it. So there's a difference between the empathy in itself and what you do with it. I think that's actually very important. I don't think I stress that actually enough in the book. But the actual empathy, would anybody who went through a tragedy want others to not feel something on their behalf? To say, well, I understand you're upset. It doesn't really bother me. If parents did suffer the loss of a child, would either of them be able to live with the other if the other one didn't feel anything in response to that? That's unimaginable to me. So I think we really quite strongly want others to share our feelings, even when they're painful. We want to be able to share other people's feelings, even when they're painful. exactly how we express that or even whether we express that is a different question. Does that get it?
Right. And yeah, no, that does. I mean, and even the, you know, in some ways, the sharing painful feelings is in a way more powerful because it's easy to share pleasurable feelings, right? So sharing painful feelings is even a greater sign of community or belonging. I mean, we all have a desire for community or belonging. And I mean, the interesting thing about Smithian empathy here is that it gives an account of what that sense of community is, a sense of sort of fellow feeling rather than kind of, you know, general abstract, you know, belief in one's membership or some kind of objective membership criterion. The commonality of feeling is crucial here. And that's quite interesting. I wanted to ask the other part about Smithian empathy that I found fascinating was the perspectivalism. I don't think you use that ism in it, but maybe I guess I put it that way, which is the way and what actually we're doing when we're empathizing for Smith is that we're imaginatively projecting ourselves into a perspective that with you know, a person who has a certain outlook in the world, with it's historically situated, with certain kinds of opinions and feelings, and that perspective is quite complex and deep and rich, and indeed outstrips most of our efforts to comprehend at any time. It's that which makes the effort at empathy constantly in need of enriching. I found this to be particularly rich because it has some deep implications for how we conceive of ourselves and our relationship to others. So it's not just that for Smith, you know, empathy can activate our sense of fellow feeling, and also empathy is sort of crucial for even understanding ourselves, understanding our own perspective by contrasting and comparing our perspective to others. So I thought maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, what Smith means by a perspective and how it's implicated with this notion of the self.
Right. I think I actually do use the word perspectivalism at one point.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I mean, yeah, empathy and perspectivalism are interwoven. I say something like that at one point. Now, perspective isn't actually Smith's own term. But he certainly does talk about a kind of interweaving of feeling and opinions, which I think approximates what we mean by perspective. And he talks about people as having a character, which seems to be a complex sort of web of attitudes, beliefs, types of actions, dispositions to act, etc. And so I think the term perspective fits pretty well what he's talking about there. He does talk very explicitly, although briefly, about how we come to be aware of ourselves. And this is actually one of the most fascinating passages in all of the theory of moral sentiments, I think. And I focus on it a good deal. I don't actually think people have attended to it enough. Smith says we don't get a sense of ourself until we come into society. The society is the mirror in which we see ourselves. And we don't even get a sense of our own passions. We act on them. We don't see them as passions, and we don't have passions for passions either. We don't have second-order desires, desires about what kind of desires we ought to have, until we start being judged by others, approved of and disapproved of by others. And then come to turn that on ourselves. So there's a kind of internalization of other people's view of us that enables us to see ourselves. But that means it's only by way of their empathy for us, which does come with judgment. We didn't really talk about that before. If you want to, we can get back to it. But they judge us because they enter into our feelings and find our feelings appropriate or inappropriate to our circumstances. And then our empathy for them, by which we understand their views of us, plus our empathy of them, by which we understand that they are different from us. It's only in that complex process that we come to see that we have a distinctive self. Now, if that's right, it makes empathy necessary for us even to understand who we are. But on the 17th and 18th century philosophical notion of a self, that kind of self-consciousness, awareness of being a self, is essential to being a self. So we don't, you can literally say we don't have a self outside of empathy. And that opens up all kinds of fascinating possibilities by which we really become who we are in relation to what we think others are. Hence the title of the book, in fact, Being Me, Being You. It doesn't just mean that I try as myself to become you. I also learn who I am by trying on you, by thinking my way into you. And I may change who I am by thinking my way into you. That doesn't necessarily mean I want to be like you. I may sometimes want to be unlike you. I might be a negative as well as a positive model. But either way, I need to have some sense of who you are and how you differ from me in order to have a sense of who I'm becoming. So in that sense, I think Smith has a very richly, very deeply social understanding of what the self is. That we exist as selves only in interrelation with others, in network with others or something like that. It's very much the opposite of the self-sufficient individual that you might get out of Locke, and that people have seen in Smith when they use him for certain political purposes. I think he has almost the opposite view, that we actually achieve our individualism only in relation to others.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess a question about this, because, and maybe this brings in the point about judgment, because I'm wondering how exactly judgment works in this process. As you point out, there's the third character in any relationship, which is the impartial spectator, which is always a sort of confusing character to many, including me and Smith. But I guess one of the worries about something like this sort of social construction of the nature of the self is, why doesn't it lead to a kind of, I don't know, a sort of, maybe just put it in a straightforward way, a kind of conservative idea of the self, which sort of enshrines current power relations and roles in society? Because on what basis do we judge ourselves or others? Well, we'll look to the current social norms that guide us. What else could we look to? I don't think that's putting it clearly enough, but I guess one of my worries is sort of what, when we imaginatively inhabit another, what do we turn to when we think about judgment?
Well, so first of all, I mean, I think you picked up on something that is a threat, if you want, or possibility for Smith, that there is a certain, I would say, small c conservatism about his view, in which we are likely to find it difficult to criticize our society in any radical way, given that we adopt so many of our norms by way of interaction with others. And that's actually a challenge for Smith, although I actually think that's only because he's more honest about our social makeup than a lot of other people are. I think a lot of supposedly radical thinkers set up principles that we're supposed to be able to access independently of everything we've learned from our society, and nobody actually does that. There's a kind of posturing that sometimes goes with that, but I don't actually think people jump to this transcendental position without some kind of social mediation, if you will. But more precisely, it's important that the kind of social construction of the self, and this is the beginning of an answer to the worry here, that I was talking about and attributing to Smith, is one in which both modeling and differentiation takes place in relation to other people. So I'm not just trying to be like other people. I'm, in fact, in some ways, I may be trying to differentiate myself from other people, and I think I think that's true, and I think Smith thinks that that's true, that in empathizing with others, some of the time I'm trying to feel as you do because I don't want to be like you, or I may want to be like you in some respects, and I may want to not be like you in other respects. So there's a constant, it's a critical process, and that's why the sense in which judgment comes in. Inevitably for Smith, empathy is bound up with judgment. Nancy Sherman, coming out of a more psychoanalytic tradition, who likes Smith in a lot of ways, but she criticizes Smith for the constant tie of empathy with judgment, which, of course, in the psychoanalytic tradition is kind of important to avoid. And I think she's right about that in the context of therapy. Certainly, you want to try to get away from judging. The therapist has to get away from judging the patient, and the patient has to get away from judging himself or herself. But in everyday life, I think Smith is right. Empathy is inextricably bound up with judging. Whether we want to or not, if I think that your feelings are suited to your situation, I'm going to approve of them. If I think they're unsuited, I'm going to disapprove of them. I may approve of them or disapprove of them in some other ways as well. But sort of inevitably, if I share your feelings and share the feelings that you actually have by way of projective empathy, I am, as it were, putting my seal of approval upon them. And vice versa, if I don't. And that process of judgment helps me not only give you clues as to how I think you ought to live, which you may or may not want to hear, but it gives me clues, maybe more importantly, about how I want to live. If I think that you are overreacting or underreacting to a situation, there's some people who don't feel pain strongly enough or don't stand up angrily enough against insult, that gives me a sense of what I would like to do instead. And I think that we can have this to our social norms as a whole, and Smith certainly seems to think that. There is a kind of process of imminent criticism that can go on even as we adopt social norms. We don't adopt them blindly, we adopt them critically. We get some sense of how we ought to judge in various circumstances, but that might lead us, for one thing, to turn our society's norms against themselves. We can say, well, here you are, as Smith, for instance, himself seems to believe, we believe in this, in freedom here in Europe, but we enslave Africans. He's very disapproving of that, actually, unusually for his time. We judge the poor unfairly, even by our own standards. So we can use our own standards to criticize our own society. We can use the very standards we get from our society to criticize it. We can also criticize our society or people around us, individuals around us, for not being well enough informed before they make judgments. That's very important to Smith. That's part of the function of the impartial spectator, to be well informed. Also, the impartial spectator is, as the name implies, impartial. You don't try not to just blindly take sides, just judge in favor of those who you already feel warmly to or where you have a stake in the situation and so forth. So in all these present possibilities for a kind of imminent critique of our society, but there's no real transcendent critique for Smith. And that's actually why some moral philosophers don't like him. They want to say what we need instead is the categorical imperative or some utilitarian principle by which we can stand outside our society and judge it as good or bad. I don't actually think that has helped all that much in, for instance, fighting things like racism and sexism. I think Smith's mood of imminent critique is basically just as successful. But if you think we need radical change and you're not going to get that by Smith's kind of learning of morality through social interaction, then you probably want somebody other than Smith as your moral guide.
Yeah, well, maybe that describes me. I mean, let me ask it in this way, to maybe compare and contrast with Kant, because you draw the contrast with Kant at a couple places. But one of the things that strikes me is that Kant, I think, can accommodate some of the things that you talk about. I mean, after all, in the Critique of Judgment, Kant discusses the sensus communis that we should sort of strive to achieve with others. He talks about these three rules of thought, one of which involves a sort of enlarged thought to encompass others. I mean, all of which, sort of seems to encompass both a enlarging ourselves beyond ourselves to understand the perspective of others. I mean, so in some ways there's an element of a kind of top-down rationalism in Kant, but also what strikes me, and this is in part what I'm working on now myself, is the way in which there's a kind of bottom-up construction of reason out of some anthropological elements. But I guess what's the main difference there between Kant and Smith, though, is that Kant has an objective principle that can sort of ground judgment ultimately that otherwise, that, you know, this sort of Smithian view of the self, one of the worries I have is it seems like it's in a state of flux or becoming, right? So it's hard for me to see how I can ultimately judge where to stand if myself is always in flux.
So first, let me just say, as you may know, I started my work on Smith as a Kantian. I'm still in a lot of ways a Kantian, even if I criticize Kant here and there in the book and want an alternative. And my first publications on Smith were on how Smith influenced Kant. Kant was very interested in Smith. Smith was said to be Kant's leapling, his darling among the Scottish moral philosophers. He refers to him at various points. And I think specifically that the talk about the sensus communis in the Third Critique, and especially in particular the maxim of enlarged thought, may very well be influenced by Smithian empathy. That the maxim of enlarged thought really is a maxim of thinking yourself in other people's places. Hannah Arendt uses it that way in her lectures on Kant's political philosophy. I think she should have looked directly to Smith, which is where I believe it came from. And I think she would have found a better source for what she was trying to talk about. It's fairly clear that she never read the Theory of Moral Sentiments. She read The Wealth of Nations, but not the Theory of Moral Sentiments. But I think actually there's a close connection here between Smith and Kant. And so the resources you're finding in Kant, if you're looking there, I think are actually from Smith. But setting aside the historical point, we would all like a not just objective principle, but a clear objective principle. In some ways, Smith also has an objective principle. The right thing to do is what the impartial spectator says would be the right thing to do. The problem is knowing what that might be and pinning it down. And the categorical imperative sounds like it makes that much clearer. But as we both know, for centuries, people have struggled with what the categorical imperative actually tells us about concrete situations. The first critique of Kant in Hegel, that you can use it to justify property and you can use it to justify abolition of property. And that, in fact, that specific example has been true throughout. Both Marxists and hardline libertarians appeal to Kant on occasion to defend their principles. And since both want us to be consistent, either always respecting a certain notion of private property or never respecting it, they can both use the categorical imperative to justify their positions. You can justify marriage, you can justify free love. There's some people who think this isn't true, and there are at least some limited results we can generate from the categorical imperative. Chris Korsgaard, of course, thinks that, but even she thinks that it's only a subset of morality that we could possibly justify that way. I would suggest, and here I don't know whether you and I would disagree that much, that Kant himself largely does not use the categorical imperative as a recipe for resolving moral situations. It's a kind of a background structure that tells you something about what morality essentially is and its relationship to freedom in particular, why it is that morality is and must be autonomous, but it doesn't resolve particular dilemmas. Barbara Herman had a wonderful piece in the early 1980s, The Practice of Moral Judgment, about how you actually have to come to the categorical imperative with some norm in mind, which you then might run through it to test it or something, but it doesn't give you norms on its own. So I don't know that even on a theoretical level, Kant improves on Smith. And on a sort of ground level, if we just look at the personality of these two guys, Kant certainly does worse than Smith. Kant was deeply sexist, racist, and anti-Semitic for most of his life. Maybe he was less so in his last decade. I think so. Others don't. But Smith has this kind of openness. He's a bit sexist, too. I don't think he does so well on that front. But on racism, he's remarkably un-racist for the 18th century. So if you're actually looking at which of these sort of moral guides, as it were, the categorical imperative or what we might call the impartial spectator procedure, actually helps foster, cultivate people who are open, able to criticize their societies, able to stand outside of prejudices and so forth, I think Smith is going to look good. Now, that does, I do have to admit that Smith sees ourselves, at least as I read him, as constantly in a process of becoming, changing, but that doesn't mean constant and wholesale change. Still, a strong family resemblance, we might say, between me at one time and me at an earlier time. And I still can have a general notion of a character that you have or a character that I'm trying to attain. Smith constantly talks about characters that we have, virtues that we have that we're trying to attain or working towards or actually hold or something. And yes, the idea that moral ideals and moral norms grow out of this much messier process of social interaction and this somewhat vaguer, harder to pin down notion of an impartial spectator point of view rather than a principle. It makes the business of moral judgment more complicated, less definitive than we might like. But if that's what we want, then I think we're going to distort what moral judgment actually does look like. I think we all have to accept that, in fact, moral judgment is often difficult, controverted, complicated, something subject to revision. If Smith gives us a picture of moral judgment that looks like that, as opposed to one in which there's a principle and you should either get it right or wrong once you use the principle correctly, then I think Smith is right.
Yeah, here's a question. I don't want to belabor the Kant Smith. We can talk for hours, I'm sure, about that, but I don't want to bore people. Here's a question though. Do you think Smith, you know, as part of the moral theory that stands behind this, affirms a kind of consistency of character in the way that you said, or is it something that would be open to revision? I guess one of the things I have in the background is somebody like Kant or somebody like Nietzsche, who also has a view of perspectivism like Smith. Both of them sort of advocate for striving towards some kind of coherence or unity of our character over time, because we are constantly torn in many different directions and bombarded by many different social pressures and natural pressures. And one of the kind of human achievements is to form a unified perspective. Is that the same in Smith, or does he affirm more kind of this sort of multifariousness and sort of playfulness of identity, changeableness over time?
I certainly don't think there's anything playful about his conception. It's not Nietzsche in that sense, and it's not some of these post-Kantian romantics. He doesn't have that picture of virtuous character at all. Look, I think, tell me if this is helpful. I think of Smith really as a latter-day Aristotelian with a virtue ethics rather than a principled ethics, a bundle of character traits that we should all try to attain. In that sense, he's universalistic. However, unlike Aristotle, he does not hold the unity of the virtues thesis. He sees a trade-off between certain virtues, such that in some societies, for instance, he explicitly says, in commerce, people are more likely to be prudent and punctual and have high integrity, but they're more likely to be very generous in pastoral societies. That's partly to do with the goods that they have to share, as it were. People are much more likely to be courageous in what he calls savage societies, partly because they're at war a lot. And they're likely to be a lot more, I don't want to say cowardly, but let's say at least diffident in a highly refined commercial society. And there are individuals also. There's some people who excel in prudence. There's a lower and a higher kind of prudence. And there are others who excel instead in some kind of grand gesture, as it were. And you're not going to get a single package that's right for everyone. a single package of virtues. There are various kinds of virtuous characters, and that's in the plural. So he is, in a sense, a pluralistic Aristotelian, if that makes any sense. But that is still an ideal of a, at least more or less, unified character, a character that resists many of its momentary urges, that tries to fit in as best it can, in which we try to fit in as best we can with other human beings and be sensitive to them and open to them and fulfill various purposes and do both respect them and show kindness to them and so forth. So there's certainly a, it's not amoral by any means, and there is a kind of a unity of character traits, as it were. Even if it's rough, it's less well-defined, and there are more trade-offs in it, of the kind that you would find in Aristotle. And that's what we're trying to attain. There's not a single rule for what we should do in each circumstance, but there is a kind of character we should be striving to be and a kind that we should be trying to avoid. So in that sense, I think it's not plainful, and there is some kind of unity here, even if it's vaguer than in some of these other thinkers. Does that address what you're concerned about?
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. I mean, can I take it back to the Aristotelian tradition rather than the romantic post-Kantian tradition? Right. Is very useful. Yeah. So let's shift, because I'm looking at the clock here. I wanted to ask you about the challenges to empathy, which have been getting popular. And as you said in your statement about the motivation for the book, Paul Bloom's book came out, which is Against Empathy, you know, got very popular press attention for the book. As far as I understand his view, it's largely a critique of the contagious form of empathy. That is, that for Bloom, contagious empathy is, you know, it's limited in scope. It's usually for our in-group, not for the out-group. And so it tends to exacerbate conflict in the way we spoke about earlier. And so it doesn't seem to affect the Smithian view of empathy. I don't know if there's anything else that you want to add about the critiques of empathy that you've seen, if there's anything useful or illuminating. I don't want to simply dismiss them, but if they don't seem to, you know, really affect the Smithian view, we can move on, as it were.
Well, I wouldn't say quite that. Bloom has read Smith. I think he conflates him too much with Hume. And that's a problem, but a lot of what he thinks, at least, and not entirely wrongly, that some of his critiques tell against Smith as well. And remember, Bloom, by his own admission, was for empathy before he was against it. I mean, a lot of his earlier work was on the importance of empathy, and then he came to see some of its problems. And I think he, and I should say Jesse Prince, who was there before him and who he cites actually as helping inspire his Against Empathy, they both have pointed out some real problems with the emphasis, I might say overemphasis on empathy, especially contagious empathy in our contemporary world. By way of empathy, to take a few of them, expanding on what you already said, by way of empathy, we can focus too much on one person and not enough on lots and lots of people. So we'll get very, very upset about a problem when we've seen a picture of someone or we know somebody who is suffering greatly. And if we took the amount of money we spend or effort we spend to help that person, we could buy 5,000 mosquito nets, which would protect 5,000 people from malaria, for instance, is an example. I may get the numbers right wrong, but I think that's actually one of Bloom's own examples. And it's certainly true that it may sound boring to just send out some mosquito nets, but that may actually help a lot more people live another day than some of the more expensive things we do because we care about some individual person. So that's one thing. There's also the fact that Bloom thinks that because of the way in which empathy can encourage in-group feeling and make it grow, it can make us more vindictive about others. We feel extremely empathetic to the people in our in-group and hate the out-group even more. The main thing that I want to say is that although I think even Smithian empathy cannot be the whole story in a moral theory, that's one reason we were talking about the impartial spectator before. Smith's moral theory is not that we should just be empathetic and that will take care of all our problems. We have to be empathetic in an impartial way. That means we have to see all sides in the conflict. It means we sometimes have to pull back from our immediate ties to people we're particularly close to. And at times, Smith will bring in utilitarian concerns, especially when he's talking about large-scale policy. Sometimes you do need to think about the numbers when you're trying to come up with policies for a whole society. So I think Bloom and Prince have brought out some real problems with an overemphasis on empathy. And my point simply is, well, it is two points, and two important points to the book, actually. First, that Smithian empathy isn't subject, as you said, to nearly as many of the problems that Bloom and Prince point out as human empathy is, partly because it's so much more active process and it's so much more complicated and involves so much more reasoning and active use of the imagination, including use of the imagination to empathize with people on the other side from you in conflicts. And then secondly, that empathy needs to become, this is still under the first point. The first point was that Smithian empathy isn't subject to some of the critiques. And I said that's partly because of the nature of the empathy, and it's partly because Smith adds in the impartial spectator, et cetera. But the second point is that what Bloom and Prince want us to do is just go to an affectless utilitarianism. And they entirely miss there, I think, the crucial role that empathy can and must play in our moral lives. And that's multiple. It enables us to feel connected to people. It motivates us in many ways. But the most important thing, I believe, is that without empathy, we cannot fully understand other people's goods and other people's harms. That the kinds of cost-benefit analysis that they want us to turn to is basically impossible unless we take an extremely shallow view of human life and reduce everything to sort of a very bare notion of pleasure and pain, which really completely distorts how people live, what people want, what people care about. If we are really trying to think about what matters to people and see what's good to them for them as what they really devoted to, what they commit themselves to, and what's harmful as what gets at their core projects, we're going to need empathy. So I actually think that the problem with utilitarianism to which Bloom and Prince and others want us to return is that it has the wrong conception of the good. So we're getting to a pretty fundamental level here. I think that without empathy, Smithian empathy, we not only don't have a full notion of ourselves, we also don't have a full notion of what the good is.
Yeah, I found this section all quite persuasive. I wanted to maybe broaden their point just briefly to try this on. I don't think they make this critique of empathy, but I can imagine it going something like this, that one of the things that empathy is subject to is manipulation. I mean, I think they do make this point in the context of the contagious empathy, but I think you can imagine this in the context of Smithian empathy too, that the media can direct our attention to particular people or particular groups of people to whom we then projectively identify, and it excludes others that we then are not privy to projectively identifying with in those cases, so that they can draw on that on our empathy to move us in certain kinds of directions. And so, I take it the ideal would be, well, maybe if we abstract from our empathy, then we wouldn't be subject to that manipulation, and we can have a more unbiased view. I mean, what do you think? Do you think that a manipulation can affect the Smithian view of empathy as well?
Well, sure. I mean, especially because Smithian empathy depends so much on imaginative projection. If you're encouraged, I say, in fact, that for Smith, Smith explicitly encourages us to turn to imaginative literature to enrich and expand our capacities for empathy and for moral judgment. But imaginative literature and journalism can focus you on certain stories rather than others, so that you are only thinking about some groups of people rather than others, often an in-group, sometimes a particular out-group. But I guess I would resist a little a premise of your question, which is, and it's a, but it's not, it's something a lot of people say. I don't know that I would talk about the media as a monolithic group. I mean, in some ways, it's obviously not. The people who are watching Fox News and the people who are watching MSNBC are getting an entirely different picture of the world. But I also don't think there's any kind, at least in a free society like ours, I don't think there is, there's not a whole lot of coordination among what the media, what various media outlets are drawing your attention to. The danger comes if you are led only by one kind of media or one outlet to empathize with a particular group and not to empathize with another group. One of the things we need to do consciously, and if we take active control of both our information and our empathies, as I think Smith urges us to do, is turn to a number of different media outlets. Get a lot of different sources of information. And don't just get it from the media. Also read novels and take your own conversations with people into account. And don't take in what you see and read and hear purely passively. Take it in critically yourself, using your empathetic capacity both to understand the stories you're given, but also sometimes to criticize them, to ask, well, what's missing? What might I be missing in this picture? So there are certain media outlets, I believe, I think all of us believe, that are clearly out to manipulate us. All of us believe that, but then we have different picks about which particular outlets are doing that. But we can resist. I don't think that's true of all media outlets. I think there are others that try very hard not to do that, to try to broaden us and give us a variety of perspectives and show us the complexities of a situation and then have us try to make up our own minds. I have certain outlets that I would praise for that. But again, people might disagree with me. But I think we can all try to use the media to accomplish that kind of balanced outlook. I think balanced is what Smith means by impartial, to resist manipulation. We don't have to give in to, even when it's explicit manipulation, and certainly when it isn't intended as manipulation, but we're led in a certain direction by various media outlets, we don't have to yield to that. And I actually think Smithian projective empathy can be a tool in not yielding to that, but not just that. Attempting to be impartial, attempting to correct, and critical, to attempting to correct what we see or hear in one place with what we see or hear in other places. So there's a danger that the media, especially where it is monolithic, as in totalitarian states or states on the way to totalitarianism, sometimes in periods of kind of populist fervor, you see this, that then media outlets will converge and try to push everybody in the same direction. And that's a danger to be looked out for, but it can be resisted, and it certainly can be resisted where you have a wide variety of outlets as we do.
Yeah, that's great. I wanted to finish off with the last chapter, if you're up for two more questions. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
Okay. Good. Yeah. We are skipping, or I'm skipping over a vast treasure of other arguments and details in the book. So apologies for that. But I encourage you to go and read the book. So the last chapter, though, is again continuing. This is sort of some of the political discussions we've been having. It's on empathy and demonization, which is quite an interesting chapter because it's quite timely. Given our current political climate, we have a president that demonizes individuals, but it's not just our president. We have significant negative polarization in our country, where the left and right tend to demonize one another. So, I guess the first question is just how would a Smithian suggest that we navigate our current political climate? What would a Smithian have to say about this demonization?
So, I wrote that last chapter partly because I have heard the term demonization used a whole lot, and I have used it without thinking closely about what exactly I mean by that, what we mean by that. And I was struck by the word demon and wondered whether people have thought about what it means to be a demon and what it means to make other human being to be like a demon. And as you know, I actually found Kant more than Smith helpful on this, because Kant has a sort of really striking discussion of demonization, of the demonic as something that cannot be human, that human beings cannot be demons. And I think in that he actually expresses a deep enlightenment outlook. Smith is so convinced that nobody is a demon. He is so empathetic in his treatment, even of his political enemies, that the idea doesn't even occur to him, I think, to discuss it. But then I tie it back to Smith because I say that to demonize is essentially, and this is how it fits into the theme of the book, to demonize is essentially to refuse to empathize and to see the person that one demonizes is incapable of empathizing. So the first answer to how you deal with a world in which demonization is common is to empathize. And indeed, particularly to empathize not with your in-group, but with the people you're inclined to demonize. So the first response, I don't know if it's a cure, but it's at least a way of pushing back against the tide of demonization, is to empathize precisely with the people you're inclined to demonize. In the book, I talk about that in the context of various conflicts. Again, Israel-Palestine is particularly on my mind because I've been very involved with that, and it was on my mind when I was writing it. Today, obviously, you could just take that advice and apply it to every single conflict that is polarizing America. For many people, I would say, and I think people I know and hang out with would say, the most important thing is to begin to deeply empathize with African Americans, to understand the depth of the suffering they've gone through, how that's built up over the years, and why all these repeated police killings appear to them, I think rightly, as part of a deep pattern, a deep system. But for people like me and the people I hang out with, the hardest kind of empathy is not with African Americans, but it is with white racists. It's very hard for me not to demonize them, but that's why it's most important for me to try not to. That's why reading about them and trying to understand where they're coming from as they were, that doesn't mean agreeing with them, is a particularly difficult project. The book Hillbilly Elegy got its reputation, I think much deserved, because it led a lot of America into the mindset, as it were, the way of thinking, the perspective of people in Appalachia, many of whom went on to vote for Trump, as I believe the author of the book did. I think he was quite enthusiastic about Trump, although he doesn't say that in the book. Reading the book gave me some insight into what was going on. I recently read a book, I've also mentioned this elsewhere, called Defying Hitler, by a man who went, when he wrote this under the pseudonym Sebastian Hafner, which was about growing up as a young, somewhat high class and generally liberal lawyer in Germany in the 20s and 30s. And although this guy was very clearly anti-Nazi all his life, he sees his friends going along. And he helped people in Germany understand how that happened. The book was actually only published after his death in the late 1990s or around 2000. But it became a bestseller in Germany, partly because the younger generation had constantly said to their parents and grandparents, how could you possibly go along with the Nazis? And his account, very detailed, thoughtful set of observations, helped people understand how they themselves might have made choices to go along with the Nazis if they had lived in similar circumstances, or how it would have been hard to resist it. So the first thing to say is, a Smithian, I think, would make it a deep attempt to empathize with people on the other side of the issue. But in addition to that, Smith himself is a big believer, again, very representative of the Enlightenment in this, in gathering information, learning more about people on all sides of all issues, in truth-telling as opposed to buying into fantasies and looking for accurate information and looking for accurate history, understanding one's own history. Smith is actually very committed to history. I don't talk about that in that book so much, but elsewhere in writing about Smith, that's been of interest to me. All his works, The Theory of Moral Sentiments and The Wealth of Nations and his lectures on jurisprudence and the things he wrote about astronomy and physics, he's always going into the history of a discipline or of a series of economic policies and so forth. I think he thinks, in this sense, maybe anticipating Hegel, that you cannot understand where you are now unless you understand how you got here. And you need honest, clear-headed, impartial history. And I guess that's the other thing. An effort at impartiality, even if we never fully achieve it, is crucial for getting beyond polarization. The idea that that's an ideal, that we want impartiality, that we want not to... Impartiality for Smith certainly doesn't mean indifference. It doesn't mean not feeling anything. It means being able to feel with people on all sides of an issue and hearing different voices, hearing as many different voices as possible. All of that, I think, is crucial to trying to push back against demonization.
Yeah, good. Last question. I wonder if there, in your view, if there's some limits to empathy, or if there should be some limits to empathy. And I have this in mind, like, you know, maybe some demonization is good now and again. That is, that, you know, for to create and maintain a common moral culture, it might be good to demonize Nazis, say, or white supremacists, that to open oneself up to anyone and to have a kind of comprehensive moral understanding maybe is incompatible with developing some kind of common core of a moral culture. I say this as a kind of, you know, there's just sort of a, you might say, the counter-Enlightenment challenge to the Smith's Enlightenment view, because this is, you know, to have empathy for everyone and to have a successful society built on that is a kind of Enlightenment ideal, whereas someone like, I think of Nietzsche and the use and disadvantage of history for life, where there's a, you know, there's a necessity for closed horizons sometimes in order for the, to have a kind of, to have action, to have it's a sort of commonality of purpose, that empathy might at its limit point pull us in too many directions if we're empathizing with everyone at once.
Would it be okay with you if I read a quotation, the last footnote of my book?
Yes.
Okay, so it's from Christopher Browning, very well-known historian of the Nazi period, and from the preface to his book, Ordinary Men, which is about the members of a Nazi police battalion that committed a series of horrific massacres. And he says in the preface, I think maybe towards the end, clearly the writing of such a history requires the rejection of demonization. The policemen in the battalion who carried out the massacres and deportations, like the much smaller number who refused or evaded, were human beings. I must recognize that in the same situation, I could have been either a killer or an evader. Both were human, if I want to understand and explain the behavior of both as best I can. What I do not accept, however, are the old clichés that to explain is to excuse, to understand is to forgive. Explaining is not excusing. Understanding is not forgiving. I think that's wonderful, wonderful line of passage. And that would be basically the answer I'd want to give you. Empathy, in Smithian sense at least, does not mean loving everybody. It doesn't mean excusing everybody. It doesn't mean forgiving everybody. If I empathize with a Nazi in the sense that I understand how they got to be what they are, I can see how they came to some of their views given the situation they were in and the information they were fed. That doesn't mean that I agree with them. It doesn't mean even that I think I would do the same thing. I may condemn them for that while empathizing. In fact, as we said before, empathy goes with moral judgment. Sometimes it's negative moral judgment. This kind of empathy does, at least. So in holding up empathizing with everyone as an ideal, I am not saying don't judge. I'm not saying excuse everyone, not forgive everyone, certainly not feel loving towards everyone. I do still think that empathizing with everyone, even with Nazis, and I say this as the son of two Jews who fled from Nazi Germany, and I have many relatives who were killed by the Nazis. Empathizing with everyone, even the racists and even the Nazis, is essential, if only to understand how they became what they were, so that we can help other people not become like them, if only to be able to talk to them if any opportunity arises of being able to change their minds. It's not going to be so common. And I think this is the most important thing, to make sure that we don't become like them. The closed horizons, I think, and this is the sense in which I think a kind of Nietzschean outlook has had a very baleful impact on 20th century culture at many, many moments. The closed horizons, the idea that we need to close down and just cut certain people off, I think has always led us both to commit atrocities and to get into violent conflict where that wasn't necessary. If our answer to everyone who defends the police currently is to say, we don't want to hear from those people, we should throw them out of office, or we should burn them down or something, then I think we will not come to any kind of peaceful resolution of the current crisis, even if those people are entirely wrong, as I'm inclined to think, and even if completely rethinking our police structures is something necessary. But the response to social problems that says, let's just throw out the old, and particularly, and I'm thinking now about revolutions from the French Revolution through the 1917 Soviet Revolution. Constantly, when violent revolution has produced only violence or more oppression, in this sense, I mean, I'm inclined to sympathize with Gandhi, although I don't go as far as he does with nonviolence. Sometimes, even if we're going to be empathetic towards everyone, we still might need to be, we might need to use force to prevent them from doing what they're doing. I certainly do think that we need to do that with white racists. We can't implement what they're asking. And if they come up with violence, they may have to be stopped with violence. But as much as possible, that should be something we don't want to do. As much as possible, we should be trying to understand them and instead to reach out to them, to their humanity, and thereby ideally to turn them too into humanists who recognize our humanity, but at least to make sure that we ourselves remain human, that we ourselves don't start behaving in as demonic a way as it's possible for human beings to behave. So the fight against demonization, which is the fight to empathize with everyone, absolutely everyone, even if we judge, is a fight to preserve our own humanity.
Well said, Sam, and thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you joining me on the Political Theory Review.
You're very welcome. I've enjoyed it, Jeff. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.